Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches Podcast. This is Adam Gordon. We appreciate you tuning in. And today we're joined by Marlon Stewart of Oregon State. And Marlon and I sit down and talk Dick Bennett and Tony Bennett and Mike Montgomery and Wayne Tinkle. And we talk about everything he knows about pack line defense and motion offense. Really a fun conversation. We jump right into X's and O's. So a little bit different. We hope you enjoy it. Marlon, what's up, buddy?
Oh, not much. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for taking the time to jump on the Rising Coaches Podcast.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime.
Well, I wanted to jump right into it because I'm excited for this conversation because I'm excited about pack line defense. And you are one of the – I'm not going to make you say this, but I'm going to say it. I feel like you are a master of the pack line.
I would argue that, but I would say I love the pack line, and I'm willing to talk pack line defense anytime anybody wants to.
So. Beautiful, I love it. Who's the pack line OG?
That's Dick Bennett, without question.
Okay, great. And
Dick Bennett, without question.
And you started off as a manager working for?
For Dick. Dick Bennett at Washington State. Tony was his assistant there. And at the time, I honestly didn't even realize how fortunate I was that they decided to go to Pullman. Dick had retired at Wisconsin and decided to come out of retirement and go take over Washington State my freshman year in college. And I just wanted to volunteer and stay around the game. And it was one of the most fortunate things that ever happened to me.
And then the current like leader in pack line defense is Tony Bennett, who obviously just won the national championship, who you later went on to work for at Virginia. So, yeah, you're a master of the pack line. I'm saying it. It's official.
I love it.
Were you like, because I was a manager too, and I tried to pay attention, and I learned a ton from my 4 years at Tampa. But half the time I was, off in la-la land during practice, zoning out. How much did you really lock in and learn from Dick Bennett, the originator?
Not enough, definitely not enough at all. I was lucky because when I started, we were using VHS tapes. And by the time I graduated from college, everything was, we shifted from VHS to DVD. And then everything, as I was leaving, was all done on the computer. And I was good with computers and VHS tapes. And unfortunately I played a lot of Nintendo growing up and so they needed me around to help with that. And really my last 3 years, I started doing more video stuff and that's where I really started to, lock in and watch practice more and help them cut stuff up. And I still didn't know what the information was that I was taking in. I was just taking in a lot and listening and, that's where I was lucky to go back to Virginia later on, because then there's all this information that I had that I didn't really know what it was, and really to see it taught again. Fortunately, we had a lot of freshmen that year, so I got to see them teach everything. That's really when it all started to sink in and make more sense. And
I'm sure when you were back at Virginia with Tony, some of the stuff that you remember hearing at Washington State came back to you, I would imagine. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I still run around saying, I was like a 23-year-old video guy at Cal walking around saying stuff like I knew what I was talking about. I was just regurgitating what Dick Bennett and Tony Bennett said. But I was right sometimes, but I didn't really understand what it all meant. So going out to Virginia, there was a lot of the stuff that I had kind of taken in and believed, but I didn't totally know why I believed it or how it fit within everything. So maybe I was right at Cal, but it was out of context. But at Virginia, it kind of put everything into context. And then, there was a lot of things that I'd forgotten, whether it was pack line stuff, motion stuff, and hearing kind of in the meetings, as a manager, you're not in meetings. So hearing in meetings kind of the thought process behind why you do what was great out at Virginia.
Okay, so trying to figure out why you do what. We played pack line this year at SEMO, mm-hmm. and this was our first year doing it. I loved it. the thing that was like kryptonite to us, all right, was wing ball screen, where the weak side post lifts from the block to the guard spot. We called that Buffalo action, like back at Clemson. So that action just killed us because we're hard hedging ball screens, and the other big has to take on the dive. So, you know, you can stun all you want at that big lifting, but if he can really shoot, it's a problem.
You're in trouble. That's the one. That's the one secret I got to keep locked away. That's the one call that, as I left, he said, this one stays. This is a Virginia deal. So I'm going to keep that one locked. But some of the alternatives, because we ran into the same issue. We ran some pack stuff at Montana. We put it in when we first got there. And when we could, the best thing we could do is in times when we could switch, you know. And I think the hard part, probably like you're saying, is, you know, you want to be consistent with all your hedging, and then you get into situations where certain guys can't switch, and so you don't have that option.
The other thing
we did at Montana was
Hold on, let me ask you a question about switching, and then we'll get into the rest. So when you switch a ball screen, and, you know, we called it the buddy system. So the two bigs were taking on dives for each other. So if you're switching a ball screen there, let's say with the four, it was the two and four switch. So now is the two on the buddy system, or is the four helping off of a guard to take on
dives? At that point, there would be you would either have to say there's no buddy system. You know, if we're switching one through four, there's no buddy system, or you'd have to be willing to say, all right, you know what, we're going to let the two front the post and say, all right, you know, we called it X in the post, so the buddy system. So say you switch two to four, and then all of a sudden the five goes and has to hedge a ball screen. Now he's got to be on the buddy system, I would say, with the four, you know, just to keep your rules consistent, because you don't want to have to teach one through five how to get on the buddy system. To me, you know, you want to reduce the number of people that are thinking about it. And you want to make it about you versus about them, and say, this is our four and our five versus I'm guarding their four or their five. So you always know who your four and your five are. So I think the less confusion and the less they have to think about when things are going, the easier it is for them.
Yeah, I agree, and that's part of the reason I love Packline so much, is because I feel like it's by far the most simple defensive system, and there's so much less thinking for your players. But if
it's just hard.
So yeah, it is. So if X4 switches on to the two, and the two is an all-league player, he's still buddying off of him, no matter what. No matter how good he is, you're going to do what you do, even if you're leaving Damian Lillard open.
1, 2, and 3 better be ready to stun, you know, stun or emergency switch. They get, you know, it's an alertness and an anticipation thing. You know, it's really, defense comes down to how alert you are, how much you anticipate, how much you know what's going to happen. And I think that's, you know, like you said, the beauty of the pack is it's simplified. So it allows you to anticipate because you know your rules. You know, it's okay, it's hard to beat these screens, but I'm going to do it. So that part's simple. I don't have to think of whether I'm going to cheat it or go over the top. I know what I'm doing. So things like personnel and what their sets are and what I can anticipate becomes a little bit easier.
Yeah, no question. No question. Okay, and then if you do switch, no, I'm sorry. Go ahead and talk about what you were going to talk about. What the other alternative that you guys did?
Oh, the alternative was the buddy system. You know, which we kind of got into was, you know, it's just going, which we did, you know, most of the time. And really anytime it's nice when there's a non-shooting post, you can get straight into the buddy system.
Yeah, no question. If their bigs don't shoot it, like, you're right where you want to be. It's perfect.
Yeah, you know, everybody dream, but problem is everybody shoots it now. So.
Right. All right, I remember what I was going to ask you is, so... Did you have guy? I know you did. When you have a guy that kind of transitions, plays at some three, some four, sometimes you want to go small. Those guys just have to learn the buddy system and learn two different ways to guard. Or is there any other way around that?
We'll say that one more time. Sorry.
So you got a Joe Harris or somebody who's like a three, but sometimes you go small ball and put them at the four. Are they just having to learn the buddy system when they're at the four, and then when they're at the three, they're not on the buddy system?
Yep. Yeah, and that's where, you know, a lot of times as freshmen, I think you know, it's always the decision of, well, we teach them both positions, and you kind of go through those, and you end up teaching them both positions because you move them back and forth between the three and the four. But they've got to learn both of those spots defensively. And actually, another deal that actually fits that we did somewhere else with the ball screens is the idea of everything's based around the tag. So you decide what you're doing based on the tag, and you treat one through four the same, and five is always getting back. And it kind of determines where you would have to put your tag. But we, you know, you could say the tag always comes from the weak side corner. So if I'm going, it's easy when the corner's filled and they're rolling up behind, wherever I'm going away from, that's the tag.
And weak side corner. Just to clarify, when you say tag, you're talking about chipping the dive. Or
the dive,
whatever.
Yep.
Whoever's taking on a dive, that's the tag. So when it, the corner's filled, that's an easy, obvious corner's tagging. Yep.
So if that's the four, if that's the three, if that's the one, the five setting the ball screen, he's getting back. You know that the weak side corner, wherever I'm going away from, that's the tag. Now, I think the situation you presented, let's say the four is lifted and there is no weak side corner. Everybody's in front of you. The tag comes from the strong side corner. So he's got to get across to the opposite block and maybe a step or two up. And that hedge better be great. You cannot let him. So this is, you know, for teams that are hedging, is you've got to get that thing driven back towards half court. And that five's got to get out of there. And you're zoned up two on three until the tag can get back to the weak, to the strong side corner. You know, that's something that fits. And I think the hard part is the pack is you're usually not on the midline, so you've got to come a little bit further to get over to the tag, but that's another alternative.
Yep. No, that's great. Yeah, I guess the other action that really hurt us, and it's pretty similar to what we already talked about, but instead of raising that opposite post, you know, to up past the 3-point line, they just kind of flash him to the elbow and hit him and be 2-on-1 with the dive. Is that the same
people,
same issues?
That would be the same issues. You know, I think that would probably end up being a scout specific deal.
Is that another trade secret that we can't get rid of?
We actually didn't see that when I was at Virginia. We didn't see that much. You know, I think to me, you'd probably come out of that saying, we're going to do the buddy system. Unless in a scout specific situation, it changed that, because as that ball screen's happening, you don't know, you know, you guys are where they're at. So if he lifts as it's happening, you're already making your call. You're already saying what you're doing. So you just got to do it well. And now if they start hurting you, obviously you can make an adjustment if they keep going back to it and just say, all right, let's treat that like he's already lifted. But that's one thing. I think on the flip side, you always look at what you should do offensively. I don't think people dive cutters on ball screens and lift guys to, you know, I think everybody kind of does like a roll replace type deal, but just lift guys to random spots and change the coverages for the other three defenders enough offensively, because that can really mess with your defense.
Yeah, it was a scout thing. Like when we played Murray State, they were really successful running that action against us. You know, and we were initially start off, we were on the buddy system. And so, you know, he was taking on the bottom post, the weak side post was busy taking on the dive, and the opposite post would flash, you know, right to the logo in the middle of the paint, catch it. And now, like, if you come up, you know, it's a dump down dunk. If you don't come up, you're giving up a little, you know, 12 footer or a drive. So it was definitely a scout thing. And what we ended up doing, you know, against that and the Buffalo action where they're raising the opposite post to the three, we just went drop coverage on those wing ball screens and just said, forget it, you know, in scout specific.
Yeah. I think that's a really good action, because one thing, it's such a short, easy pass that it's the ball is going to move so quick that it's hard to recover and get to where you need to get. As long as whoever's lifted to that, you know, free throw line area, if he can pass it and make decisions, it puts you in a bad spot.
Yeah, it was really good. It was really hard to guard. Anyways, let's move on. So anywhere else that you did pack line? Because you mentioned Virginia, obviously, And then you moved on to, from Virginia, you went to Cal?
I went from Cal, so I went Cal to Virginia, and then Virginia to Montana. And when we first got to Montana, we did some things with the pack. You know, we had put it in, and then Coach DeCure kind of had his own spin on it with a lot of different things. He likes to play very aggressively, you know, and the personnel we had fit the pack better. And so then as we recruited, now you kind of see them really overplaying, switching everything, and they're playing kind of an up-tempo force you baseline, and it really fits them. They've got, I mean, fives that can switch onto ones. And but when we initially got there, we were running the pack, you know, which for me was, you know, it was interesting trying to teach people to teach the pack. And, you know, all of a sudden you start to realize, you know, some of the challenges in actually putting it in. You know, I think it's easy to sit back in the room and, you know, watch Tony put it in versus, you know, actually having to help put it in yourself. There's a lot of little nuances and different things. And even the leagues being different, going from the Pac-12 to ACC, all of a sudden you're in the Big Sky where it's smaller players, you know, a lot of guys shoot it. And so it presents different challenges for the pack. So you can't just use the same answers that you saw in the ACC.
So when you went to Montana, it sounds like you were kind of charged with teaching the pack to your staff and then maybe trying to implement it. Where do you start when you're trying to implement it to a team or even trying to teach it to other coaches? What do you start with?
Closeouts and slides. You know, I think to me watching and even watching Virginia now kind of going a couple different places and seeing a couple different defenses and then watching them on TV, the biggest thing that they do is they guard the ball. I think no matter what defense you're in, if you can close out, take away a shot, if he shoots it, you're contested. If he puts it down, you're able to contain him yourself without needing any help. I mean, when you got five guys that can do that, that are focused on preventing penetration like the pack, and there's no baseline rotations, so all of a sudden your rebounding's great. Now, you know, but it all starts with the ability to close out from challenging scenarios and then be able to keep your man in front. And that's just the post that's on the perimeter. I think it starts with closeouts and slides.
And so you're putting them in all kinds of different closeout situations and just drilling that all the time, correct?
Yep. You know, and putting an emphasis on it, you know, making sure the guys know it's important. You know, and I think everybody's got their different ways of motivating with that. But if they know it's important, and, you know, and then they start to see success with it, I think they buy into it. You know, once they all buy into it, then you're really hard to score on.
Yeah, no question. The thing that I found is, and we did it, I thought we did a pretty good job in the pack, but it was our first year, and, you know, some games were obviously better than others. But what I found is people just started jacking threes. They took an uncharacteristic amount of threes against us. And our 3-point field goal percentage defense was tremendous. Is that pretty common for all good pack teams?
I think so. You know, but part of it goes to your close or your contests too. You know, I think there's a difference between, you know, having your hands down and getting to a late contest, having a quality contest, then obviously having no contest. And if you can get teams to shoot threes that are not in their normal rhythm or at their normal pace, or like you said, I think teams become impatient because normally things come easy. Normally they get transition buckets, second chance points, or they're able to get to the paint, whether it's on a post-touch or penetration and get an inside outlook versus getting everything, having to turn your body and having to work for it every time. And then, you know, being exhausted from just having to work for everything where the percentages start to go down, you know. And obviously there's the teams that are elite shooters that can make contested threes that are going to – they're going to get contested threes that are going to mess up those averages. But I think all in all, if you stay the course with it, teams don't get the normal looks that they usually get.
Yeah, no question. I think the thing that I love the most about it is – obviously, you're not giving up baseline penetration, but when somebody does beat their man baseline, like, you're not helping, and we're not sinking to the level of the ball, and we're not on midline. So if that guy can drive baseline and score one-on-one and maybe against a late contest from a big at the rim, so be it.
Yep.
But like, we're not giving up those like baseline drive kick out threes ever.
Yep.
And I think
or the second chance points that come from those.
Yeah, no
you
doubt.
You know, because a lot of times when they kick it out and all of a sudden you got a guard coming down trying to wedge in a big, the balls are getting tipped around and it just creates a rebounding disadvantage just from your rotation.
Do you love trapping the post? Because that's like an original Dick Bennett thing.
Right? I do. I'm a big fan of the post trap. Because to me, it's about eliminating penetration. You know, it's not necessarily to force turnovers and get out and run. I think it's a way to be aggressive. You know, I don't think you just have to trap good players. I think if you see a guy's prone to throwing the ball to the other team, then let's beat him up for sure. But it's just a way, you know, to me, the three ways you can penetrate are throwing into the post, driving it, or off of an offensive rebound. And if you can take those away, teams get real frustrated. So, yeah, just getting them to pass it out is huge.
Yeah, and we had some success turning people over by doing that. But the one thing I don't like, and I get it, like that is penetration, throwing in a post, and by trapping, you're keeping it out of there. But I felt like it put us in rotation sometimes when we didn't need to be. And that's what I love most about the pack is, yep, like you're in rotation less.
Yep. Yep. And I think just drilling it enough to where guys, the trap comes so quick that guys have a hard time passing out. And then you're going to face guys, you know, Frank Kaminsky's and Mark Vershaw's and guys that can really just they can pick you apart. They know you're coming and they can't wait for you to trap them. Because they know they're going to put you in rotation where, you know, you kind of put it on and then maybe you pull it off. And then, you know, maybe it's a scout-specific deal where, you know, you say you're coming, but you're not. Or, you know, let's go on the first or second bounce or bluff them or, you know, you start playing with them a little bit. But really all you're trying to do is get them less aggressive in the post and get them to kick it out and build your defense back up. But you're right. There are games where teams come in with a great plan against it, and you got to pull that thing off right away, just because you know they're going to get great shots.
Was there any team or coach that just really did a great job game planning against the pack?
I mean, there were a couple. You know, I think the hardest thing was always teams that played with spacing. I think when teams played with spacing that had, you know, three guys that could pass, dribble, shoot, and think. And we're willing to win the battle of wills, you know. But that's not something where a team can just show up on a Monday and you're playing them on Thursday and they say, all right, guys, this is going to be a real hard game. Get your mind right. It's going to be one where we're going to have to work for every shot. That has to be part of who you are as an offense. So it was the teams that were built that way. That would give us issues, you know, both at Montana, I think Wazoo and Virginia. But I would say those ones for the most part.
Okay. I think I got my pack line fix. Anything else we need to touch on there?
I could talk about it all day. Yeah. That motion offense. Yeah.
All right, well, let's talk about your time at Cal and kind of some things you learned there from Coach Montgomery, because obviously he's a legend and been doing it for a long time and won a ton of games. What was he great at? What did you learn there? And what can you share with us about that experience?
I thought he was extremely organized, knew exactly what he wanted to do, how he wanted to do it, when he wanted to do it, and then he was great at adapting and readjusting. You know, he always had his practice plans planned out for months. So he knew what I wanted. I've got to have this in by this date. And, you know, it was very detailed. And then as the practice went, he would, you know, obviously adjust what happened in the practice and kind of rework things. And then, you know, I think about the first team we had. You know, you get there, and Stanford, it was a lot of, you know, two big men that played a lot of high-low. They have, you know, all the same sets that they ran at Montana. It's kind of the Montana coaching tree deal. And they carried those over to Stanford and had a lot of success with them. You think about all the big men and all the guys that could come off the screen and get a foot down and make a shot. And it kind of fit that deal. And when we get to Cal, And we had these incredible three-point shooters and guys that could space the floor. And so we had a plan to put all this stuff in, and he put it in, but then he was able to adapt. And I think his time with the Warriors and all the ball screen stuff in the NBA helped to give guys like Jerome Randle, Patrick Christopher, Theo Robertson freedom to have space, play in ball screens, play fast. And we ended up having, I think we were first in the country in three-point shooting. Won the Pac-12 for the first time in 50 years, but it was because he was able to take his plan, stick to it, still teach everything so that 3 years in, when we had a different type of roster, all those guys still knew the offense, but he was able to adjust it to the player's strengths so that they could have success and then, you know, go do something that hadn't been done in a half century.
So you were with him, who was one of the best, you know, set guys out there, mm-hmm. offensively, and yeah. you're with Coach Bennett, who's all motion offense. So if you get a head job today, yeah. what are you doing?
Oh, man. Probably motion with some sets.
A little bit of both?
keep it minimal. You know, I think one of the things, you know, getting an opportunity to actually have to run a defense and think about timeouts and substitutions and I think as an assistant or as a support staff guy, we're always on the sideline. This is what coach should do. Why didn't you do this? But, you know, it's easy to go think all that stuff. And then when you actually have to think it, you know, when you have 10 seconds to think about something, turn around and tell the guys this is what we're doing and have a plan for everyone and then have someone go out and either make or miss a free throw and now everything changes. I know my brain is simple enough to not be able to take all that in. And so I think the less I have and the simpler it is in terms of the sets and all that for me, for the way my mind works would be, it would just work for me better. You know, that way I can focus more on the how we're playing, what we need to do, and then have a couple random little sets here and there that fit, what our team is.
So you like,
maybe I'll be different.
You like motion because you feel it's a little simpler, it's less memorization, but it's a lot of teaching, like to get someone to really play or a team to play motion offense at a high level. It takes a long time.
There's growing pains.
In some ways, that's harder than memorizing, you know, some sets.
All the plays. No, without question. But I think it also gives you a chance to really focus on your defense. And at the end of the day, I can't shoot or dribble. And it always is kind of the way that I can get on the court playing. I've always just liked defense more. And so I think it allows, one, for you to teach more defense, but then it gives you something for your defense to work against that's unpredictable every day. So guys don't know where stuff's coming from, and you can work against a lot of different actions in practice just by working on your offense.
And are you, you know, that Virginia motion or Washington State motion, that's kind of the blocker mover with designated screeners? Or less of a true five out motion where everyone's kind of interchangeable. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the blocker mover, you know, it was kind of a more of a free, you know, you had basically two blockers and three movers, and then there's, you know, I think you could switch it up and go really kind of three and a half movers and one blocker. You know, and the guards had total freedom. There was a few more guidelines and rules, you know, don't cross. And, you know, coach always tried to have them start in a different way. So get into offense differently every time.
Don't cross. And then the screen, what is that? Have, don't cross underneath.
Like two guards. No, just kind of like two guards, like ships passing in the night, just kind of like floating by each other. Gotcha. So if I'm coming at you, you know, you're not just going to run by me and interchange. You're going to reject or go somewhere else. And really it was pretty cool for the post because they became the quarterbacks of the offense. You know, they had their areas. So if I was, you know, a 3-point shooter, I might have freedom to work out towards the three and pick and pop a little more. You know, if I was a big bruiser, I was probably up the lane line, but they're directing traffic and telling guys where to go. And then, you know, there was times when guys needed more kind of railroad tracks and a little more of a simpler offense. And that's where that kind of circle motion, where it's just kind of their flare pin down, occasionally rescreen and ball screen. And it was a little more predictable, but those guys got so good at it, no one could beat them. And they actually, I think they ran that in 2012 before I got there, and then I brought it back in 2014. And then you watch it this year, and they ran that ball screen motion, you know, and the way he gave him freedom in that, and then a little more freedom in the circle motion was, they actually be interested to learn a little bit more about that, because that was a little more than what we were doing when I was there.
I love a couple of the terms you just threw out. Number one, I feel like it's hard to get sometimes bigs to buy into just being a screener, even though we all know the screener is the guy that often scores. But just calling them the quarterback of your offense, you know, gives them a little buy-in and incentive, and kind of glorifies that position, which I love. And it's true. You really are directing traffic as a screener. And then I love the railroad tracks for some guys that need a little more structure. That's great.
Yeah. And there was freedom within the structure, but it also let everybody know, you know, where everyone's going to be, you know, so it's, you know, it's, I would imagine it's like the Mike Leach offense where you kind of have your boom, A, B, C, D versus something where there's just total freedom in what you're doing. And you know, it's more like a jazz concert instead of an orchestra. I guess would be the best way to put it.
I love it. You're sounding like Steve Lavin right now, getting off on into music and flowing
like that.
Yeah, it's good. All right, and it sounds like you did some really neat stuff as an assistant at the University of Hawaii. Number one, you're the defensive coordinator, and number two, it sounds like maybe you guys had a big emphasis on analytics. Is that accurate to say that?
Yeah, a lot of statting, and it was stuff that was specific to Hawaii, which was really cool. You know, and Coach Gannat is incredible in terms of giving you ownership and freedom to run. You know, you are the head coach of certain aspects of the program. And that was honestly probably in basketball the most growth I've had with, you know, especially as it's basketball specific. I mean, it was an opportunity that I would say most people can't get unless they become a head coach, you know, and he does a really good job of motivating you to be the head coach and really take pride in what you're doing. So yeah, that was an awesome year. Plus Hawaii's not a bad place to live. So.
And you did a lot of international recruiting there. Is that seems like par for the course if you're at Hawaii.
Yeah. And I got into a little bit, but I was really only there for 11 months. So I got there, kind of went to the European Championships, and then we got to April, and then I ended up coming here to Oregon State. So, you know, where I've been able to be the recruiting coordinator. So Coach Rupp's done a really good job internationally here. And so we've been able to tag team that a little bit, which has been great.
How was the European Championship experience? Is it stupid that more coaches aren't over there?
I mean, it's not for everyone. You know, I think you got to know what you're doing over there and know how to evaluate. You know, and I think for certain teams, the system's got to fit the players. You know, I think it's easy to go over there or to hear what people are saying and say, oh, he's really good. He's this, he's that. But then you don't think about how he fits within your offense. And it really hurts the transition of, you know, players wanting to come to the U.S. because they go to these systems where, you know, a kid might be, you know, a great thinker and ball handler and this and that, but then you end up just sticking them in the corner because you can shoot, you know? So I think it's good for certain teams, and then it's not for everybody. You know, and then I think being able to evaluate and figure out what's going on, for whatever reason, I like European basketball. So even like right when Twitter was starting, I just started tweeting at all these guys that were tweeting about European championships because it wasn't online, it wasn't anywhere. So I kind of got to know people over there, and I've been following it for probably 10 years now as much as I can, and you know, websites have come and gone and all that, but you kind of get a feel for the landscape of it and a way to evaluate guys. And so I think unless you can really do that and figure out how to do that, I don't know if it's worth it or not
for you. That's really good insight. You're right, like a lot of guys will take a couple international guys here or there and not really adapt to them, and you really do. You got it's a different style, it's a different emphasis over there, and I think you see that a lot, where you just have like a random international guy sitting at the end of the bench, that never really, you know, the system doesn't fit them.
When they could probably go really help someone win games. And then it makes it hard because then they go back and they say, you know, they just don't have a quality experience here with college basketball. And I think it could be a great thing for both sides, you know. But I think it's expensive, and there's, you know, people that really have to commit to evaluating over there to make it worth it.
Just like anything, just like the Pac line or Recruiting International, you got to really be all in on it and committed to it if you're going to make it work. And if you are, anything can work. All those systems work.
All right.
So then you go from Hawaii to Oregon State. And before we talk a little bit about Coach, Gill Coliseum is one of, like, the coolest gyms in the country that I've been to.
It really is.
It's got such a great, like, old school vibe to it. It's got a great atmosphere, great lighting in there. I know that sounds weird, but we played there when I was at Mississippi State. We got our brains beat in. What an awesome venue. And it was packed. Like, I don't know if it's like that all the time, but it seems like there's great support there, and I was really impressed.
Well, it starts with the students. So, like, the arena or the Coliseum itself, it's a historical landmark. So it's amazing. There's certain things where, you know, we're doing all these upgrades, and there's certain things we can and cannot do in certain ways. We have to go about doing them because it's actually a historical landmark, which is, to me, it's really a cool deal. And you feel it, like you said, you feel that when you're in there, it feels historic. But we did put in a brand new scoreboard, which is massive since you've been here. The lighting has actually been redone. All the seats are black now, and I think they're going to keep, you know, adjusting things to make it, you know, I think even 4 or 5 years from now, it could have a really, really cool feel to it and still keep that historic, feeling. But with the fans, I always thought that, to me, you know, NBA in the NBA, people go to watch the players. In college, they go to watch the teams, and they go to watch the students root for their peers. And here, the students show up for everything. You know, you go to a baseball game, they're there. You go to the football games, they're there. I mean, it was raining and cold late in the year. We were struggling. Students, there were still 3,000 students down there. You know, the whole thing was filled. You know, and in the basketball deal, it's the same. You always look across, and they're filled up there early. You know, and Coach Tinkle sitting over there talking with the students. And the rest of the town, I mean, it's, you know, 30,000 students, and then it's a college town. Everybody shows up to see that. And so it creates a really, really good, really cool, really hometown feel kind of energy, which I love, you know. Plus for me, it's close to home. So I got friends coming down now. It's been a really good deal here.
Now you can feel it. Like you said, when you enter that gym for a game, you can just feel it. All right. Quick fun fact. I got a fun fact for you about Corvallis before we get into Coach.
Yeah.
Our time's running out here. Did you know, I don't know where I read this, but I read it on the internet, so it's got to be true. Corvallis is the safest place in the country to live in terms of natural disasters. There's no natural disasters that you guys get hit with, and crime and all that stuff factored in.
And crime. Yep.
How about that? So if you're like,
dad,
go ahead.
I said that to my dad about 3 weeks ago because we found that stat. And then the next week, there was a flood.
How about that? Well, I hope I didn't just jinx you.
It was pretty cool. No, I think it happens like every 10 years, which is, so now we're good. Now I got a decade of absolute safety. So, and the flood was actually that. There was a guy driving his boat down the highway. It was pretty cool. So it was the safest flood you've ever seen.
That's funny. All right, tell me about Coach Tinkle and what makes him so great, other than the fact that he looks like he could be like a G.I. Joe character. Obviously a great coach. Has done a tremendous job at Montana. It seemed like when we played against those teams, like, everything was done with a purpose and organized, kind of like how you talked about Coach Montgomery. Everything seemed in order. Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, the whole organization and kind of the way the program is run, and everybody's got their own style to it, but that comes from Montana. You know, going back to Judd Heathcote, before he went to Michigan State, you know, Brandenburg followed him. and then Mike Montgomery, Stu Morrill, Blaine Taylor, Don Holst. And then you got Chris Stojak, who played for him. Blaine Taylor, who played for him and coached with him. And then you got Chris Stojak, who played for him, and then Tinkle, and now Travis DeCuire. You know, they all played for or worked with within the Montana tree. So they've stayed within that deal since the 70s, and it's worked. And each guy has their own personality and their own way of doing things, but there's a certain organization and structure and really just kind of way to be and way to function within a program. And, you know, both on the court, off the court, and there's a consistency to it. Now having worked for three of those guys, that makes it special. And he's definitely got that here. And I think with his own specific spin on it, you know, offensively, he's dialed. He knows how to get people in the right places and keep things organized. And then he's an incredible motivator. You know, he's a guy, you know, and I think that was a huge part of me being here with him is, you know, I was able to get close to home with a guy that I knew I wanted to be around. At the level that, I mean, shoot, Pac-12 level, it's what I grew up with. And he's a genuinely good person, and he's who he is all the time. You know, and I think that is an incredible trait, you know, to have someone who 24/7 is the same guy. You know, he's a good person, and he's fiery, but he does it in a way of this is how good you are. You know, we're going to get there. And there's an intensity to it that's just so motivating for everybody that's around. And he truly believes that for the guys, for his staff. So I think that's where probably, when you played against Oregon State, there was probably a passion with the players. And like when people went on runs, you could probably feel it in the whole arena because it just resonates through him.
Yeah, no question. Because they did. They went on a massive run to start the game. I think they started the game 20-4 or something. And it was just overwhelming. And we had to dig ourselves back into it. Ended up going down to the wire. But, yeah, you could. You could feel that run and that passion through everybody, you know, in the arena. It was not fun. Not a fun experience.
It's always good to be on the opposite side of the
Yeah.
No, I mean, we'd get down this year, and even on the flip side, he always felt like we were in it. You know, and we had some massive comebacks that fell short and some that we got done that, I don't know, there was just an ability to rally. And, you know, I think it starts with him. So
are you guys hard hedging? I know when they were at Montana, they were hard hedging ball screens, but at that time kind of everybody was. Are you guys at a thing?
Yep.
That's his deal? Like, that's what he does all the time? Or has he kind of changed his ball screen D through the years?
We mixed it up. You know, part of it was we mixed it up just based off personnel and who we got, you know. You know, we have a kid right now. I don't know if he finished the year as the nation's leading shot blocker. But he, for the most of the year, he was the nation's leading shot blocker. He's long. You know, so we play a lot of zone as well. And so we'd switch up our coverages and man and zone and try to keep them consistent, but we'd go into games with different game plans. We had a couple of different things that we did this last year.
Have you embraced the zone? I know, like, that's like a bad word to backline people.
I have. It's been actually really good to one, having to put in a zone at Hawaii. That was like that broke me. That was like, all right, now I can do this. You know, I had John Montgomery there. He helped me through it. And then there was three teams in the Big West that ran 1-3-1s. So I actually had to learn the 1-3-1 and put in a 1-3-1. I've actually really liked the 1-3-1. But no, I've opened up to it a little more. I probably wouldn't run a zone if I had my own team, but now it'd be a hard deal because I'd probably be talking myself into it now just because I actually understand them enough to appreciate them a little more.
That's good. I love it. Well, Marlon, listen, I really appreciate you jumping on the podcast, and more than anything, you were one of the, 30 guys who were at the very, very first Rising Coaches Conference way back in 2010 in Vegas, in a hotel ballroom in Vegas. And you've always been willing to give back to the organization and came and spoke a few years ago And I just want to make sure I let you know how much that's appreciated. And it's crazy to see how that thing's grown over the years.
It really is. I appreciate you reaching out and inviting me over there. It's been awesome. You know, just so many friendships and people that I've been able to, you know, not just keep in touch with, but we've been able to help each other throughout the years. And just watching everybody grow and we're getting older. It's crazy.
We're not that young, Marlon. We're not that young.
No. I probably should go down and work out right now.
Well, good deal, man. Well, thanks again, and I appreciate it, Marlon.
No, I appreciate you having me on here.